This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Podcast has been paid for by the New World Order. Well, you know something, Hulkamaniacs, dude? You're listening to the hard-traveling fanboys, brother. Nick Duke, Greg Phillips. They're bringing it to the stratosphere, even the ionosphere, dude. Thank you, Hulk Hogan, for that wonderful intro. That's right, I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke. What was that, sir?
That's pretty good. You know, it's always a big deal when you can get the Hulkster on. And I love the fact that stratospheres and ionospheres are becoming recurring references on our show after Ben Morse's appearance a couple weeks ago.
That's right. Well, you know, that's actually how we got the Hulkster for this appearance. He listened to last week's show, which I think everybody did in the greater continental United States, and he actually phoned me up, and I said, oh my God, is this Hulk Hogan? Because the number, of course, on caller ID said Hulk Hogan.
Yeah,
and that's
the actual number, like not just the name, but the number itself.
The number itself is Hulk Hogan.
Well, Hulk Hogan.
And I said, is this the Hulkster? And he said, no, it's Hulk Hogan. And I said, oh, what's the difference? And he said, nothing. I'm just joshing with you. And then we laughed for 5 consecutive minutes. And then he said, I would love to do your podcast, brother, because I heard you mention the stratosphere and the ionosphere. And I would really like to come on and promote you. And so, pal, we're not going to turn down free promotion from a celebrity, right?
No, absolutely not. Especially not one as esteemed and with a pristine moral character as Hulk Hogan.
That's right. And that's the kind of moral turpitude that you can expect here on our podcast, the Hard Traveling Fanboys. You know, we've got future guest appearances already lined up. From noted R&B singer Chris Brown, he'll be making an appearance. You know, you can expect a lot of other appearances from famous celebrities, including O.J. Simpson, who will be appearing. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. I mean, and we're trying.
I do take some issue with the fact that you're comparing Hulk Hogan to Chris Brown and O.J. Simpson, but I digress.
Well, I mean, listen, I don't mean to compare their exploits, but all had significant careers in the entertainment medium, and all have made great contributions.
To society.
Society. Yeah. Anyway, moving on from that. We are the hard-traveling fanboys, and we have come to you with – I don't even know how else to describe it except to say that it is the largest podcast ever in Place to Be Nation pop history. And only we could provide this to you because we are, after all, the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history.
So only we would be able to provide that. And Nick, I think that you've actually calculated that we're actually being, you know, a bit modest with our continual proclamations of our episodic nature.
Yeah, because I got thinking on it, you know, ruminating on it a little bit, if you will. And if we're the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history, seeing as how all the comic book content is localized on the pop feed, would that not, by default, make us the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in the entire Place to Be Nation family across the entire network?
I believe it would. You know, we haven't missed a week that I'm aware of. We've been there every week.
We'll really have to check with the folks over at Guinness who obviously keep up you know, our the record keeping for these sorts of things as it pertains to the Place to Be Nation family. But we'll get back with those people and see if we can't get an answer for you on next week's show as to our eligibility for that particular honor.
Yeah, and we'll let you know what we find out as well. And my God,
what is that?
Is that the ho ho loot? No, no. I'm sorry. It's the fantasy football update, folks. False alarm. Fantasy football update, which has returned to Place to Be Nation, and it appears that both Nick Duke and I are cellar dwellers in our in our shared fantasy football league.
9th and 10th, something like that.
Something like that. Not a productive season. And let's just say heads are rolling, coordinators are being fired, and Orgerons are being hired. So
Orgerons, Hermans. Don't forget about the Hermans. Yeah.
Hermans. You have to have Hermans, Hermans. or Hermans, Hermans even. And that has been your fantasy football update, mercifully. But in all seriousness, folks, now that that's over with, we are bringing you the most significant podcast we've ever done.
One might say it's the most significant podcast in American podcasting history, if not global podcasting history, if not universal podcasting history.
We don't want to go that far. I understand that Neptune has some pretty rocking podcasts.
You would have to think it would at least be in the discussion, though, Greg. Maybe not a clear-cut number one, but, you know.
You would think so. I mean, you know, after all, there are a couple of truisms in the world of podcasting. One, there aren't enough wrestling podcasts. And two, there isn't anything that can touch what we're about to bring to you right in just a little bit.
When Greg says there aren't enough wrestling podcasts, he means that we have the perfect number here at Place to Be Nation and everywhere else has the problem.
That's right. Everywhere else. I'm talking about the Sam, whatever his name is. I'm talking about the Josh Rosenbergs. I'm talking the Aubrey Sitterson or whatever his name is. All those people, they don't work for us, and thus they're not relevant. We are the relevant wrestling podcast home, and the relevant comic book podcast home. And you can catch all of our wonderful podcasts at placetobenation.com, at placetobenation pop on Podbean, iTunes. Whatever your preferred method is of listening, we've got a litany of great podcasts out there. But that's not the point of this episode. The point of this episode is we're going to bring you a special off-the-page looking at – honestly, calling it a fan film feels like an insult. Mm-hmm. One of the greatest films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. And I think I speak for Nick and our guest tonight, Mr. David Sunday, longtime listener of the show. We've referenced him several times. He'll be joining us as we delve into the fan film known as Watchmen Rorschach. Mm-hmm. Boy, I'm excited.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be fantastic. And you know, usually with these off the pages and the Hard Travelers for Hire, those series of shows, Greg and I bring you some pretty, you know, maybe not in depth analysis. You know, but some amateur analysis from our perspective, and you'll be pleased to hear that on this episode you won't get nearly as much of that because we'll just be giggling nonstop for 40 minutes, essentially.
Yes, wheezy laughter and coughing caused by the wheezy laughter. Yes. Expect lots and lots of that, and we hope you stick around for that. But first...
And if there are any medical professionals who listen to the show that can tell us probably what is causing the wheezy laughter and coughing, that would be helpful.
Yeah, honestly, I'm a little bit concerned. Like, I honestly have been considering going to the doctor for why I have a wheezy cough every time I laugh now. But in any event, we are going to kick things off with a little segment we like to call the rundown.
Oh, and this is switching things up a bit on me.
That's right. Shaking things up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this is the part of the show where we like to run down, so to speak, some of the top news and notes items in the comic book world. Not a very busy week this time around. Not a lot going on.
Holiday week, so I think a lot of people didn't want to drop news and have it get lost in the holiday shuffle. So no big losses there.
Right. To kick things off, we've got to look at the Fox cinematic comic book universe. as word has come out that Fox has scheduled two new Marvel movies for the next few years. They've got the dates November 2nd, 2018 and February 14th, 2019 for unspecified Marvel movies. Nick, are we pretty certain these are going to be X-Men related movies?
Well, considering the Fox rights, based on my understanding, and correct me if you have better knowledge, but I think the only two properties they still have the rights to would be the X-Men franchise and the Fantastic Four franchise. And I think everybody knows that the future of the Fantastic Four on the big screen is what, you know, uncertain at best would be the best way to put it. So I would assume these are going to be some sort of X-Men related films. As you know, as we've talked about, you know, Deadpool 2 will certainly be out before then, but Deadpool 3 is already in production apparently, or at least in a pre-production status. And there's also New Mutants films in the works, as well as an X-Force film in the works. So you would think that February date would make a lot of sense for potentially Deadpool 3 or X-Force if Deadpool is gonna feature in that. And I would think the November one would be a likely landing spot for either the long in development Gambit solo movie or perhaps that New Mutants movie that that's been bandied about for a while.
I'm going to go out on a limb, and I actually think they might use that November spot for, you know, obviously rebooting the Fantastic Four. Not a great idea at this point, given how bad the last few have gone. I'm thinking a Mr. Fantastic standalone movie.
Oh. And of course, it's going to be called Reed Richards. Propeller Arms will be the
Propeller Arms
will be the official.
That's
title.
Right. And Reed Richards will be played by former Vice President Dan Quayle.
I'm for it. I'm absolutely for it.
But so that's all we have on that story, folks. Quite frankly, there ain't much to it. I mean, you can't manufacture news when there ain't no news. So we're going to move on to the next item, quite frankly, and that is we're going to stick with Marvel, and we're even going to stick with the X-Men because a pretty major announcement came through this week. On the day that we're recording this, which is a Monday night, we just got word this afternoon that Marvel Comics has officially revealed the long-awaited details about the two new X-Men titles, X-Men Blue and X-Men Gold. We have got creator and cast announcements, and we've also got the revelation that both of these books will be twice monthly. Mm-hmm. As Marvel takes that
measure. And I looked pretty hard online to see if there was any indication of what the price would be, because $3.99 at twice monthly is, that's kind of tough, but if they were going to completely rip off the DC model and go $2.99 twice monthly, that would make a lot more sense in my opinion, but I couldn't find that information anywhere. So if you have that information and you want to share it with us on the Place to Be Nation Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, I should say, that would be much appreciated.
Yeah, it definitely would. We certainly appreciate that. I hope that it's $2.99. If it's $3.99, there's no chance I'll be able to buy these. But let's get into some of the details of these two books. Starting out with X-Men Gold. This is going to be written – I'm sorry. Actually, let's start off with X-Men Blue. This is going to be written by Cullen Bunn and drawn by Star Wars artist Jorge Molina. Nick, are you familiar with
yeah.
Mr. Molina?
Yeah, he's been doing some recent issues of Star Wars and done a very good job. That's one thing about Star Wars, the main Star Wars title, and really all the Star Wars titles that I've read – pretty much since the line started, they have that outstanding art across the board, and Jorge Molina is just another in that series. So, you know, based on what I've seen of him on Star Wars, he seems like he's going to be a good fit, and should at least keep the books aesthetically pleasing, or this book.
Yes.
I should say.
And Cullen Bunn is the writer, of course, well known for his runs on solo villain books such as Sinestro for DC, Magneto for Marvel.
And that's really the catch here. I think the link here is that, you know, he has that famous run on Magneto, and as they also announced, the cast of X-Men Blue will be the original five 1960s time displaced X-Men. Those, of course, being Cyclops, Jean Grey, Iceman, Beast, and Angel. But the catch here is that they're going to be mentored not by Professor Xavier, but by the modern day version of Magneto. Which kind of sets up an interesting angle, I think, because you have apparently these five characters who remember their previous encounters with Magneto when he was a bit more of a one-note villain, and here they're being mentored by a more nuanced, almost anti-hero version of Magneto. So, I mean, it, you know, I'm probably not going to read this just because I don't have that childhood link to the X-Men the way that I know you do and our cohort Tim Capel do. But I will acknowledge that while I'm not overwhelmingly invested in any of these characters that are on the cast, I think this combination of Magneto and latter-day X-Men makes for an interesting concept for a book.
Right. I think the concept of Magneto as the mentor is, while it's one that's been done before, it's interesting in the modern context. However, the big hang-up I have with this book is I'm just not interested in the original five. The time-displaced X-Men to me was a flawed concept from the get-go, and when you turn it into a long-term thing, it just doesn't – it has never worked for me. From the moment that the Bendis storyline happened – I know a lot of people love that story, but from the moment it happened, I had huge reservations about it because to me it just further convoluted the X-Men and made it even harder to understand what was going on. It also has all kinds of time travel ramifications that I don't want to get into, but you know, the fact that Cyclops' children now are all older than he is kind of weird and makes it very difficult.
Well, they're older than this version of Cyclops, you know.
Well, sure, but that's the only version of Cyclops. The other Cyclops is dead.
Just happened, though. And, you know, death in comics is a revolving door, so...
Right, but
I'm not under the assumption that this is going to be the only Cyclops for the foreseeable future, because the Iceman title... You know, the solo title that's been announced could, you know, the rumor is that it's going to feature both Icemen. So,
right.
You know, it, I don't know. Granted, I'm not as down on the concept of the original five as you are, but still not likely to read this, as I said.
Yeah, it's something for me that, I don't know, I was hoping for a streamlining of the X-Men, and it's hard to do that when you're dealing with characters who were taken from the 1960s and put in modern day.
Well, one thing you have to remember is that
or, probably, I'm sorry, not the 1960s, but taken from the early days of Marvel's floating timeline, I should say, which
right.
Now might be like the mid-90s, I guess, or early 90s.
Right, and one thing I think that probably played a role in this is you got to remember the reveal of young Bobby Drake as a gay character that probably played some role in the decision to keep these characters around, I would think, anyway.
Oh, sure. But I would think that you could just translate those changes over to, I don't know, adult Bobby Drake.
And... You would think that, but that would, you know, require a comic book company to not attempt to have its cake and eat it, too, you know?
Right, good point.
Which both companies are notorious for doing.
Absolutely. In any event, hopefully the book is successful because the X-Men deserve to have some success. In the other book, which I am actually much more interested in from a conceptual standpoint, X-Men Gold, Arrow co-showrunner Mark Guggenheim will come back to the X-Books to write it, and he'll be joined by Ardian Syaf, a Superman and Green Lantern artist. He drew the pre-New 52 Green Lantern core book for a while. And Emerald, I believe it was Emerald Warriors was the name of the book. He also drew that, I believe.
Yeah,
and,
the Guy Gardner book.
Yeah, and did a good job on that. I've got kind of mixed thoughts on this. I've not ever really been blown away by Guggenheim as a comic book writer.
Yeah,
I love Arrow,
neither.
But what were you saying, Nick?
Yeah, me neither. I mean, I like you, I love Arrow, but his comic work sometimes leaves me a little cold.
Yes, and Ardian Syaf is a good artist. I don't think he's amazing, but he's good. He's really good and a good fit for this book. Now, here's why I'm excited. Listen to this lineup. Kitty Pryde leading the team. Nightcrawler, Rachel Gray, Storm, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and Old Man Logan.
Man, two Nightcrawlers on one team.
That's right, two Nightcrawlers. Two Nightcrawlers. There's Nightcrawler and then there's Nightcrawler, according to my butchering of the team lineup there. But in my defense, how do you not have Nightcrawler and Colossus paired together in the listing of the characters? Come on, Newsarama. Anyway, anyway, you've got the classic X-Men characters of Rachel Grey, Nightcrawler, Colossus Storm, Old Man Logan, and Kitty Pryde together. To me, this is almost a perfect X-Men lineup.
Yeah, getting Kitty back with the X-Men is a big deal. That even for a non-X fan, that draws me in a little bit, because her recent trips out in space with the Guardians of the Galaxy just did not seem like a particularly Kitty Pryde type of thing, you know? Now, granted, a lot of my Kitty Pryde fandom comes from the Ultimate Universe, where, you know, the bizarre nature of Lockheed the Dragon and stuff was never really a thing, so I'm not really aware of how she fits into the whole cosmic universe side, you know, of the Marvel universe. So,
and one of the things that I love about what Guggenheim is saying, anyway, in these interviews that he's doing, is that this is going to be about getting the X-Men back to a superhero book, because it hasn't been that for a long time. It's been about, you know, people trying to avoid extinction. It's been about end of the world type events. It's been about wars with the Avengers and the Inhumans. And this is going to be about rededicating the X-Men to going on adventures, to being superheroes again. And whether or not this specific title is successful creatively, I think that in general, the direction is a good direction to go in, because the line has been so beaten down by events and by just convolution and by drastic character changes that it's necessary and important to streamline it back to, why did we fall in love with the X-Men in the first place? And it wasn't because, you know, there were only 50 of them on the planet or whatever, or 300 on the planet or whatever. It wasn't because they were on the verge of extinction. It was because they were a marginalized group of people who were hated and feared by people and still stepped up to defend the people that hated and feared them. And it's going to be really interesting to see if this book can recapture that feel, in my opinion.
Well said, sir. Well said.
And with that being said, we only have one more news item for you, and that, I believe, comes from the pages of DC Rebirth of what we can expect coming in early 2017. Nick, can you handle that one?
I think I can. DC has recently published its first edition of a magazine known as Direct Currents, which should be free in your local comic shops. It's supposed to be available to consumers and retailers alike. And the idea is just to kind of give you an idea of the direction of the company right now. So in that first issue, Dan DiDio makes some revelations about kind of what you can expect to see in 2017. And three of the things he mentions are three of the major hanging plot threads left over from the Rebirth special that kicked off the Rebirth initiative earlier this year. The first of those being the disappearance of Ray Palmer, the Atom. Apparently that will be handled very much directly in the opening story arc of the upcoming Justice League of America title. So you got that to look forward to, finally getting some closure on that plot point that was introduced of Ryan Choi and Ray Palmer and who will be the Atom going forward in the DC universe. Also, apparently we're going to get in 2017 finally, more of the Flash and Batman working together to unravel the mystery of the comedian's button that was found in the walls of the Batcave in the Rebirth special. And finally, DiDio promises that in the pages of the Superman titles, we will get a definitive answer on the identity of Mr. Oz, who has been, you know, most fans are under the assumption at this point that he will wind up being revealed to be Ozymandias of Watchmen fame.
Yeah, and all of these mysteries have been floating around since, obviously, the Rebirth special came out. And it's going to be great to see resolution to these, at least some resolution, because I don't think any of us expect the entire Watchmen story arc to be resolved anytime in the very near future. I think we're looking at probably a 2-year plan, I think, from what Jeff Johns has indicated. Mm-hmm. But it'll be great to get these initial mysteries out of the way, particularly finally putting to rest the Mr. Oz character, and the mystery of him anyway, and explaining a little bit, hopefully, the motivations behind some of the moves that he's done. We've seen him take prominent characters from the pre-New 52 continuity, whether it be Tim Drake, whether it be Doomsday, characters that were big in the 90s and the 2000s.
And there are more cells that were shown in his little, you know, his holding area that he had that we saw whenever he took Tim Drake in that Detective Comics issue. So clearly he's got plans to, you know, for other characters. Now, what those plans are, hard to tell.
The other thing that hopefully we'll get resolution to is what was his role in the New 52 Superman, really? We've gotten several kind of panels teasing that everything is not as it appears to be, and everything has not been as it appeared to be with regards to Superman, in particular in the New 52. I saw a fan theory floated around today that I wanted to run by you, Nick, because I really loved it. And I don't think it's going to happen, but I loved it. The fan theory is that either on his own or through being manipulated by Ozymandias, that Dr. Manhattan has – what he did with the New 52 is he manipulated existing characters and twisted them just enough to turn them into these other characters. And the fan theory is that the New 52 Superman was a manipulated and sort of reformed Superboy Prime.
Yes, that would make a lot of sense.
I would be in favor of that. I think that would be awesome.
I also think there's a potential. You know, let me give you my crazy fan theory. I think that the mysterious Clark Kent being who is still popping around in Action Comics could wind up having some Superboy Prime qualities about him, I would say. Because that's one thing that this Direct Currents magazine also promised was a resolution to the mystery of Clark Kent early in 2017. So, and that it will have, quote, some multiverse-related aspects to it.
Very interesting. I am quite curious about that. I am quite excited about the Batman and Flash team-up. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and throw out our baseless, honestly, speculation right now of what we think is going on here. Do you think that let's make some assumptions. Let's assume that Dr. Manhattan is involved. Let's assume that Ozymandias is involved. Do you think that they are in opposition to one another? And if so, which one is the good guy and which one's the bad guy? Do you, if they're, to put it in such layman's terms as good guys versus bad guys.
Bad guys, yeah.
Or do you think they're working in concert with one another? And if so, is it willingly or is one of them manipulating the other?
I think they're working together at this point, and I think this is going to be a little bit convoluted, but I think you'll understand what I mean. I think that Ozymandias thinks he is manipulating Dr. Manhattan. But that's probably not what's going on. I think Dr. Manhattan is a being of such, it's not even really intelligence, it's borderline omnipotence, that to manipulate him once, which Ozymandias already did in the pages of Watchmen, was a feat that likely could never be duplicated again. So I would not be surprised if Ozymandias thinks he is manipulating Dr. Manhattan. Dr. Manhattan, you know, is letting him think that, but going on along with it for his own reasons, which probably would involve, you know, his stated desire to create life, which, you know, I would imagine he will wind up being revealed as the one who is responsible for the creation of the New 52 through his stated desire to experiment with the creation of life.
I think that's pretty much the way that I was going about it as well. I think, except I almost feel that Ozymandias might be revealed to actually be manipulating Dr. Manhattan. Now, I have seen some who feel that this is going to be almost a redemption story of sorts for Ozymandias, where he's trying to set right what Dr. Manhattan has done in some way or fashion. I don't buy that. I don't think that Adrian Veidt actually learned any valuable lessons from the end of Watchmen. I feel like
Well, but you see, any lessons that he would have learned would have been the consequence of whatever takes place after the last page of Watchmen.
True. That's a good point. That's a good point. And I have made it clear that I think that the revelation here is going to be that the Earth of Watchmen did end up getting destroyed by nuclear war because of Rorschach's journal getting public and, you know.
Right, but you got to remember, Rorschach's journal, he sent it to, like, I mean, let's be honest, the entire time he's reading that paper in Watchmen, it's the equivalent of reading, you know, Breitbart these days. It's the crackpot side of journalism, and nobody really, you know, how much impact could he really make there, you know?
Yeah.
Good. It's a question to ask.
It is. It's going to be very, very fun to see where that all leads. But that, folks, well, that's the end of the rundown. And you know what that means. That means it's time for...
Read on and watch out. What you be reading and watch out.
What you been reading and watching.
Ah, that was wonderful, wasn't it, folks? And the man responsible for that jingle you just heard will be joining us later in this show. David Sunday will be here to talk all about Watchman Rorschach and a little bit about his jingle-making career. So, but for the time being, we're going to talk about what we're reading and watching. And as you know, last week was a big American holiday, Thanksgiving. And even though we're here in our luxurious studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, we did celebrate Thanksgiving with our families, and it ate into our time. At least for me it did. I can't speak for Nick, but I did not have time to do much of anything last week. I did watch all of the superhero television that came on. Actually, no, I didn't. I still haven't watched Supergirl from last week. But that's a, you know, time issues as they were. I did read a couple comics. But, Nick, should we get started with reading or should we get started with watching? What do you think?
Let's run through watching real quick. Shouldn't take too long.
Yep. I have not watched Supergirl yet, so I'll let you take this one.
I really don't want to say too much because I think there are some interesting plot threads that I think you'll enjoy. Some characters that pop up again for the first time in a while. I will say I very much enjoyed this episode. This episode was billed, it was marketed around the debut of Cyborg Superman, who winds up not really being all that important to the plot of the episode. The episode is really more about Supergirl's first exposure to the inner workings of Cadmus, and how all that plays out is very well done, in my opinion. I think you'll absolutely enjoy it. Unfortunately, there is more Guardian you have to deal with. I also thought that Alex continues to have standout moments in this episode, as in this one, she gave Maggie Sawyer a little piece of her mind, which I thought was very much deserved at this point. So I very much enjoyed this episode of Supergirl. I thought it was one of the stronger episodes of the season. I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on it down the road.
Very good. Now let's move on to Tuesday night, which gave us a much-anticipated episode of The Flash, directed by Kevin Smith. And this was an episode that its title may have been Killer Frost, if I'm not mistaken. And this was all about Caitlin Snow's descent into becoming Killer Frost. She's gotten these powers for reasons that still haven't been explained entirely. We don't know if it's related necessarily to Flashpoint. We don't know if there's something else going on. We don't know if she had powers on the alternate Earth. She didn't appear to in that episode, but who knows? And this was about her kind of flipping that switch, so to speak, and going crazy for a little while. And I've got to be honest, Nick, I did not buy into it. I did not buy the transformation. I don't get me wrong, the actors, again, you'll almost never hear me criticize the acting on this show. I thought Danielle Panabaker did a great job. They did a great job with the effects. The Killer Frost effects looked great. But they needed to stretch that out more, in my opinion. There was no gradual transition for Caitlin from sweet, loving Caitlin into evil, maniacal Killer Frost. I don't think they did an even remotely passable job of explaining why using her powers would change her emotional state of being when nobody else on the show's powers have ever done that to them. I just didn't buy into it. I mean, there were great points in the episode. Pretty much any time there were two characters on screen talking to one another in true Kevin Smith fashion, it was really good. All the scenes involving Joe were great. The scene with Caitlin and Barry, where Barry basically said, if you want to leave here, you're going to have to kill me, and that's what ended up bringing her back to reality. That was outstanding. Fight scenes were good. But I don't know. It just – the episode fell kind of flat to me, complete with the ultra-obvious reveal at the end of who Dr. Alchemy truly is.
Yeah, I would agree with most of that. I will say that, like, while they didn't explain why it works that way, I'm glad that they did say – blatantly state that using her powers is affecting her mental state, because that actually helps a little bit with the logic of why Caitlin would all of a sudden act so irrationally. You know, that's one of the things we were both concerned about is, you know, this wild swing in Caitlin's personality. And while I'll agree, you know, they didn't, you know, explain the mechanism very well, at least there was a mechanism rather than just, well, Caitlin's mad at Barry. You know, I appreciated that they realized,
yeah,
you know, that wasn't quite enough. So, you know, I enjoyed the episode overall. I think since the first four or five episodes of the season, The Flash has kind of hit a little lull here lately. I think there is the potential for it to get better now that the mystery of Alchemy is off the table, because they were starting to stretch that out to an unnecessary degree, I thought. But, you know, this episode had its ups, had its downs, but ultimately I'd give it a thumbs up. I mean, not a ringing endorsement or anything, but a solid episode of CW television.
Yeah, I mean, I was left, pun intended, cold a little bit by the episode, but there was enough there that I liked, particularly a really good scene with Barry and Iris, a really good scene with Barry and Caitlin, a really good scene with Caitlin and Cisco, and of course, anytime Joe's on the screen, it's amazing. The one thing I will say, they've done a great job, in my opinion, of forging this chemistry between Barry and Iris that has made it a believable, good relationship on TV, which is something that both of us thought at times last year
it wasn't,
and the year before that it wasn't. And they've done a great job with it. My only concern is they've got to find a role for Iris on the show that doesn't relegate her to just building up Barry every episode. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it almost comes – at times there's – concern of it coming off almost Robert Kirkman-esque, where it's everyone telling Rick how great he is. And, you know, you need that once in a while, but we also need to see Iris doing her own thing a little bit. So hopefully they'll do that going forward. But again, they've done a great job with her this year. They've done a great job with that relationship. And, you know, one can argue it's the first time on a CW superhero show that the intended relationship that's supposed to be the centerpiece of the show has actually worked out.
Right. Well, the only other...
It did with Smallville, and it didn't with Arrow, so...
Oh, okay, yeah, I forgot about Smallville. You know, I'm not well-versed in the Smallville as you are.
Well, yeah, the Clark and Lana dynamic that was supposed to be the centerpiece of Smallville never really worked from a chemistry standpoint. I don't think that their chemistry was quite as bad as Oliver and Laurel's was in season one of Arrow, but it was pretty bad.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so solid enough episode. Okay, so there were no other CWDC shows last week. All of them were on break. The other two were on break for Thanksgiving, which is understandable. That leaves us with The Walking Dead, which we have talked about every week since it premiered, and we've had glowing things to say about, if I'm not mistaken, about every episode this season. We've at the very least liked every episode, and frankly, mm-hmm. I've loved most of them mm-hmm. so far this season.
Yep.
This week's episode, I'll go ahead and say it. I did not love it.
No.
I did not like it.
No.
I found it immensely boring.
Yes. But that's
it was an episode
that is what happens when you seek to make a character focused episode about a character that no one cares about.
Yeah, this was an episode.
And I mean, like, I'm all for occasionally giving the spotlight to some of the supporting characters, but let's be honest, since Tara has been on the show, the writers have given us no reason to care about her at any point.
No.
She has always been, you know, Tara is one of those characters. I'm trying to think of a perfect. Tara is almost like a modern day T-Dog, in that she's been on the show for a long time, and so that you know that it will be mildly surprising when she dies, but not really that surprising. She's pretty much there to eventually be, you know, a quote unquote major death. You know, whereas a real honest major death is someone like Glenn. Someone of, you know, I would argue, let's say, Rick, Daryl, Carol, Maggie, I would argue Morgan at this point. Those are really the only five characters, and Carl, those six. If you killed one of them off, then I'm legitimately shocked. If you killed Tara off, I just kind of go, I guess that's mildly surprising.
Yeah, you're like, okay, I kind of expected that that would be the case. Yeah. That's exactly right. And you know, I do know that there are people that are fans of Tara. I know them, you know, people that I'm friends with that I've talked to that are fans of Tara. But for me, she's never been a character that's ever connected with me on any real level. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not bad. I don't have anything against
her.
No,
she's fine. The actress does
a fine job, but she's just there. Exactly. They have never given me a reason to truly sink into her as a character. And I feel like they were trying to do that in this episode, but it didn't work. No. I just found myself saying, so?
Yeah.
And a perfect example of what I'm talking about, one of the minor subplots to this episode was the little girl who is in this – they find this community in the woods that's sequestered from civilization, and they live by the water and all this stuff. Kind of a cool idea, almost like the forest moon of Endor, mm-hmm. is how I relate to it.
They reminded me of the almost like the Amazons from Why the Last Man, like all the women just off together. You know, living in their own little secluded community.
Very good comparison. I didn't think about that. That's a good idea. But the they push the angle of the little girl who's almost overly enthused about killing someone. Here's the problem: they've already been over that beat before, and it's not shocking anymore. Mm-mm. They've been over the beat of the little girl who is too excited to kill people. That was the whole point of Look at the Flowers, mm-hmm. of that entire arc. It was supposed to be disturbing, and at that time it was disturbing.
Right.
Genuinely unnerving to see that. It's not anymore.
I think the idea here, Greg, if I may, is that whereas – oh, what was the character – what was the little girl's name? Lizzie?
Lizzie.
Lizzie, yep. Yeah. Lizzie was bloodthirsty in a way that she wasn't being asked to be. The disturbing nature here is supposed to be that this girl has been actively told, this is how we treat people.
Mm.
I think that's what they were going
True.
For. And I got to say, you know, while with all that, the one small moment in the episode I did enjoy was when Tara is leaving, she flips the little girl off. I actually thought that was kind of funny.
That was funny, yeah. There were a couple of funny moments. Like the actress that plays Tara did a good job in this episode with some of the comedic elements, mm-hmm. Which was great. But it would have been better in a more, I don't know, interesting episode. Mm. At no point, at any point in the episode, did you actually think Tara was going to get killed?
No.
Because I didn't.
No, of course not.
No, and the overall
I did think Dr. Dre was going to get killed because he has to go be on that that 24 spinoff, but apparently they're leaving Dr. Dre's potential survival up in the open. And I'm using Dr. Dre because he played Dr. Dre in Straight Outta Compton, and I honestly don't know the name of that character.
Guy.
Exactly.
Quentin? I don't know. I don't know.
We'll call him Dr. Dre and move on.
Yeah, he's also not very interesting, by the way.
No. I had honestly forgotten that those two had even left after the attack on the satellite base last year. Until they showed it to me in the previously on The Walking Dead, I was like, "Oh yeah, that happened."
Right? Yeah. That certainly a unique subplot. I knew that it had happened, and I was honestly dreading the episode that was going to focus on what they were doing because I kind of figured it would be boring. And sure enough, I just wasn't interested by any of these people, by their stories, by their.
The story about the punishment that the saviors exacted upon them was somewhat interesting. I thought that was a
well. I do appreciate the way that they're tying the saviors into all of these different things, and I believe maybe setting up the massive war storyline mm-hmm. later on. But one of the things that Jennifer Smith and I were talking about this after watching it, it had a little. It wasn't quite. It wasn't as bad as Carl Eating Pudding, but it had some of the same elements as the Carl Eating Pudding episode. In that there really wasn't a lot of rising action going on. It was not. At no point were you invested in thinking that the characters were in danger. At no point was there the thought that something truly moving to the plot could happen. Because pretty much from the moment that you realize that Tara is being betrayed by these people as they're supposedly leading her to the bridge, you know that, okay, well, that kills any chance of these characters becoming new permanent additions to the cast. So,
and that's a good thing, in my opinion, because at this point, I'm actually of the opinion that the show has expanded its cast a little bit too much. Because when we have to go 4 or 5 episodes in between seeing... I mean, like, we haven't seen Carol or Morgan since episode 2 of this season. Yep. And that's just way too long to expect your audience to remember all the different subplots. I understand the reasoning behind devoting entire episodes to each individual... you know, pairing of characters and whatever their subplot is, but I actually think the show would be better served going forward to juggling more characters in a given episode and giving you little snippets of each story rather than, you know, big, long hour chunks of you know, the various subplots. That's one thing I wanted to mention. Why was this an 11-minute extended... like, why was this episode extended by 11 minutes unnecessarily?
No idea.
They've been doing that this season, extending episodes... and honestly, none of the episodes that have been extended needed extending. Not a single one.
No, you can easily trim out some of the characters looking at the forest scenes and get it to a reasonable, you know, get it to the regular runtime. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe Peter Jackson is directing some of these episodes. But it's... Oh, another thing about last night's episode, or Sunday night's episode that I have to point out that I didn't like. What was up with the every time that Tara was running, the low shot of just her feet moving?
No clue.
It like I wouldn't have even noticed it, except that they did it like 3 or 4 times during the course of the show, which indicates to me it was an intentional thing that you're almost supposed to be drawn to, and I cannot for the life of me understand why. It's almost like they needed a stunt double to run or something. I don't know. It's bizarre. But in any event, it was, you know, there were good things in the episode. It wasn't. I don't think an all-time worst contender like I've seen some saying.
It is the worst episode of the season, though. Easily.
Oh, easily.
Yeah.
Easily. Yep. Absolutely. With that being said, that wraps up our watch-in segment. I can't do it, so Nick, I'll leave you to rank the two shows from last week, Supergirl and The Flash.
Oh, Supergirl by a mile.
All righty. And that wraps up watch-in. I have also been playing. I have played episode 4 of the Telltale Batman game.
I have started episode 4. I have not yet finished it. I'm gonna have to probably re-download it. The file that I downloaded is giving me some problems with some freezing and crashing. I am up through. Let's see. I have just done the scene at the Vale family home. Gotten through that. So, if you remember that.
Yes.
Scene.
Yes, I do. We'll talk more about this next week. Hopefully, we'll remember to talk about it. That's always the problem with these is. We're on a different schedule of playing and stuff. I have been vociferous in my praise of the series, and I thought this is the first episode that gave me pause about praising it. I'll put it that way. But we'll get more into it hopefully next week once you've had a chance to – or whenever you get a chance to play through it. And we'll talk
I've
more in depth.
I've played it for quite a while today. I don't think I have that much longer to go. Typically, these are only about – 2 to 2.5 hour sessions, so
I'm trying
shouldn't
to
be that
think.
Much more from where I'm at, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, and I think that you probably have you finished the home scene?
Gordon had just shown up whenever the most recent glitch shut down my file.
Yeah, actually I'm thinking about it. You might not have anything else after that. I'm trying to think, and God, it's hard for me to actually, no, I'm. I want to say that you might not have. No. There's one more prominent scene, actually. Yep. There's. You have one more prominent scene left to go, and then that'll be the end of it. Yep.
So.
But yeah, so we'll get to that when the time comes. But let's move on to Reading. And as mentioned earlier in the episode, I did not get a chance to read very much last week, so I'm not going to be able to have a full list of comics. But I did get to read two issues of Wonder Woman, both outstanding, by Greg Rucka, Liam Sharp, Nicola Scott, and I read issues 9 and 10. I think I mentioned to you off the air, Nick, that I read 11. I have not read that yet. Mm-hmm. I read 9 and 10, and both of these were outstanding. 10 was the continuation of the Year 1 story arc, but the standout to me was issue 9, which featured Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor going on a date, and also the return to civilization of Barbara Ann Minerva, no longer in the form of the cheetah, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But the Steve Trevor and Diana scenes were incredible in this issue. Absolutely blew me away. My book of the week, Wonder Woman number 9, for an incredible love story, an incredible continual shaping of Wonder Woman for a modern era. Can't say enough about it. It's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I had high praise for that issue when I read it a while back. I said that in that one issue, they made me care about the Diana and Steve Trevor dynamic in a way I have never cared about it before in the past. So big ups on that one. So, I guess I'll run through mine real quick. You want me to go top or bottom first?
Let's shake things up a bit and go, quite frankly, with your bottom pick.
Bottom book of the week is Action Comics number 968. This wraps up the two-part Men of Steel storyline. One thing I will say about this is it does get back to being more of a little bit of an action-focused book, which is something I've wanted from this title for a little while now. But the problem here is that the antagonist of the God Slayer is just kind of generic and uninteresting, even if, you know, the glimpses of the future he shows are pretty interesting. So, again, not a bad book here, but if I got to pick a bottom book of the week, going to be Action Comics 968.
Alrighty.
And then moving on to my top three, and I'll try to be fairly quick about this. My number three book of the week, Titans number 5. This book, the entire, I don't know how many pages it is, 28, I think. The entire 28 pages take place in the span of 6.5 seconds. The entire book is Wally West attempting to pull off something that even he thinks is impossible using the Speed Force and save all the other Titans and Linda Park, who have all been transported to various locations in the United States by Abracadabra. And he has 6.5 seconds to do it, and that's the entire book. And it's the art in this one from Brett Booth is actually really well done, I thought. Abnett's writing of Wally's interior monologue as he's trying to focus on this is incredible. Loved, loved, loved Titans number 5. My number two book of the week, Detective Comics 945, the latest installment of the Victim Syndicate storyline. This Detective Comics, man, just continues to be the best Batman book on the shelves right now. James Tynion IV just knows how to write all these characters, and even as someone who's never had a huge attachment to the character of Spoiler, I thought she had some standout moments in this book, giving Batman a piece of her mind, saying some things that, you know, honestly, Greg Phillips has said about Batman and how he's kind of reckless when it comes to protecting his allies and that kind of thing. So, really, really well done here, and this book continues to impress. But my number one book of the week, which continues to just amaze me with how much it has improved, is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 9. So many things I love about this book, whether it be the John whether it be the John Stewart moments, the Guy Gardner moments, the return of Ganthet and Syed. But above all else, for the first time in honestly my Green Lantern fan memory, we get a major action scene that is focused around Rot Lop Fon, the F-sharp bell, which did my Green Lantern fanboy heart so much good.
What a pull.
Complete with the recitation of the F-sharp bell oath on the splash page. I mean, amazing. Amazing stuff here from Robert Venditti, who I don't know where this turnaround came from, but I'm so glad that it happened. Loved Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 9. It's my number one book of the week.
Yeah, that you have made me want to catch up. Russell Sellers, friend of the podcast, has told me he's going to hook me up with issue 3 of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, which will then allow me finally to start catching up on this book. But you have certainly elevated my expectations.
Absolutely. And then some quick hits. Wonder Woman number 11 wraps up the Lies storyline, and the ultimate lie is revealed, and it is a genuinely shocking reveal, and one that has me extremely intrigued as to what the future of Wonder Woman is going forward and what the status quo is going to be. I don't want to say too much because, you know, you're one issue away. Genuinely shocked by this book, that's all I'll say. Mighty Thor number 13 brought back the League of Realms from the Thor God of Thunder days, and absolutely love seeing these guys back together. This sets up to be a very, very good story, intriguing storyline. Steve Epting back on art, by the way, for this one. So, interested, you know, good to see him back in the Marvel fold. Star Wars number 25, a oversized issue that wraps up the last days of the Harbinger storyline, and also sets up, you know, kind of where the book might be going from here. Great moments between Han and Leia. Great moments for Luke as he realizes he isn't quite ready to face off with Darth Vader just yet. Awesome moments in Star Wars 25. Civil War 2, number 7. After a couple of issues where the pace picked up, the pace slows back down in this one. Although I will say I was genuinely surprised to see a couple of guest pages from Andrea Sorrentino as we get glimpses of a possible future that could be caused by the ending of Civil War 2. So, like that aspect of it. Ready to see how this story wraps up with number 8, which comes out later in December. And then finally, Teen Titans number 2. Weakest issue of the 3 thus far, that the other two being, of course, the number 1 and the Rebirth, but still a solid issue. I think Percy struggled here in a little bit of the writing. A lot of the dialogue was a little bit on the nose for my taste, but really like the art in this one, and his writing of Damian, at the very least, is pretty good. And we get the reveal of what exactly is going to unite this team, and it's an interesting concept that I'm not aware of them doing in the past. So enjoyed this one, but hoping it can improve a little bit going forward.
Very good. And with that, that brings an end to what you're reading, what you're watching. And we've set the table, folks, but let's be honest, you didn't come here to listen to what you're reading and watching. You didn't come here to listen to the rundown. You came here for one reason and one reason only, and that is, of course, the main event of the evening, the entree, the feature course of
the largest podcast ever.
When we return from the break, gosh, I'm stuttering over myself. I'm so excited. When we return from the break, David Sunday is going to join us, and we're going to look at the outstanding, vaguely dated Watchmen fan film known only as Watchmen Rorschach. Folks, it changed our lives, and our genuine hope is that it'll change yours as well. Please stay with us right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Policeman Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlacemanNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Policeman Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Placement Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlacemanNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacemanNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacemanNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easy to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back, listeners of the Place to Be Nation. And it's finally time. I mean, we have been building to this. 2 months now, and we've been promising you
the largest podcast ever
in Place to Be Nation pop history, and damn it, we are committed to providing you finally with
the largest podcast ever
in Place to Be Nation pop history, because right now, finally, after all of this ado, we are ready to present to you an off-the-page look at the fan film Watchmen Rorschach.
Or, as Jeremy Reynolds might say, Watchmen Rorschach.
Ah, yes, Rorschach. The famous Rorschach. But we're not alone on this journey. That giggle you hear in the background, making his hard-traveling fanboy's debut, one of our very, very best friends in real life, for shoot, brother. One of our very best friends, a listener, a contributor on the Facebook Place to Be Nation Comics page, Mr. David Sunday. David, how are you, sir?
I just want my phone call. And that is Coach.
David, a.k.a. the Southern Joker, as we've,
yes,
for many years
called. Cowboy Joker has finally made his debut on the podcast. And David, yes, actually has a tie to this film. As you'll see here in a little bit, for those of you watching along at home, David actually plays the part of young Rorschach in this film.
Are we committed to the Rorschach thing? Really.
That's up to you guys if we're going to keep the Rorschach thing going or not.
I'm good with it.
So, David, tell the people out there a little bit about yourself and your history with our subject of the day.
Well, first and foremost, I was going to say, I'm happy to be here. Watchmen's actually my first graphic novel that I read. So just the material itself feels really awesome to me and really hits close to home. I mean, not that I go out and kill people or do any of that kind of stuff, but it just feels pretty special because it was the first one I read.
No, but strangely enough, you do have a habit of not wearing pants so everyone can see your giant blue penis. So, you know, it all works out.
Yeah, well, giant. Giant
being the operative word, right? Yeah.
And it's very odd when you see a giant red bush on top of a giant blue penis. It's not unlike looking at an old pair of 3D glasses or something like that.
Or like Boise State's football field. Oh, man. Anyway, we're happy to have you on, of course, David. And I know that when you were reading Watchmen for the first time, you thought to yourself, man, I just don't know if it's ever going to be possible to capture what I've just experienced on film. I mean, maybe this truly is the unfilmable book. But then something changed, didn't it? About 6 years ago. Actually, probably about 8 years ago now.
Yeah, I don't even remember, Greg. How did we find this? Like,
you know, I feel like it was during the
build up to the theatrical movie, right?
Yes, I believe that somewhere in the winter, maybe of 2008, or the early or late winter, perhaps early spring of 2008-09, we were all getting excited about the upcoming release of the feature film Watchmen. And several of us had just recently experienced the book for the very first time, myself being among them. I read the graphic novel on recommendation from several of my friends, and of course it changed my graphic novel reading life, my trade paperback reading life, whatever you may. And we were all really getting excited for the movie. So I do recall we were all hanging out in the office of our campus newspaper, the Tripolitan, if I recall correctly.
No, you would have been gone by this time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So where were we hanging out?
Maybe Nick's apartment, I think.
In Nick's apartment.
Yeah. And we were if the time frame is correct, you know, we were spending an awful lot of time together, you know, again, for the first time in a little bit due to various life circumstances that all brought us, you know, led to us having a lot of free time at the same time. So, you know, I think the timing is right on that. So probably a combination of either my dorm room or possibly you were still at the house and making that crazy drive to Dothan every day. So it possibly could have been there as well.
It could have been there. And anyway, I recall we had about five or six of us at least that gathered around and we were looking for different Watchmen fan films. I think we had watched a video of Alan Moore, the author of Watchmen, reading excerpts from Rorschach's journal from the book, which was pretty cool. And, you know, we had found some videos like that. And then we hit the gold mine. Oh, man, a Watchmen fan film. We have to watch this. And one thing I'll say up front, folks, if you go to YouTube and you just type in Watchmen Rorschach or Watchmen fan film, you're going to be inundated with fan films. There's tons of them now. But trust me, in 2008, there were not tons of them. In 2008, there were only a few. And this was the most prominent one on the search engine at the time. But now you might see some actual – well, I don't want to say that. I don't want to disparage what we're about to watch. Now you might see some high-quality ones. But in 2008, they were few and far between. And we watched this video together. We huddled around the computer screen. We turned up the volume. And we experienced – what I can only describe as a life-changing event. David, what are your memories of viewing this for the first time before we get into it? And kind of how did this – I'm sure it changed your life for the better. But how did this change your life and change your outlook on not just pop culture but the human experience?
The first time I honestly was like, what the hell are they making me watch this and why? Because But after, like, I got past the initial shock, it grabbed me and honestly almost made me give up my career and decide to go into acting.
That's true. It is rather inspirational in that regard because it leaves you to think, well, perhaps I wouldn't be as bad as I thought.
And possibly, maybe I'd be even as attractive or more attractive than the ones on this film, which would be wonderful.
Yes, something that we can always use something to compare positively to that for ourselves and our group. But
and at the very least, as I'm sure we'll discuss here in a little bit, you probably took some pointers from the way this film depicted approaching counseling and psychology and things of that nature.
Yes, it actually helped me decide how I was going to groom myself.
Oh, yeah.
Not yes. The way Nick's going with it, but
And how much food you would consume in the process.
Although you and I, Greg, are closer to that guy.
I actually think I could pull that guy off. But we'll get to him in a few minutes and talk about some of the counseling tips that David took from the doctor in this film. But here's the thing about this fan film. It was uploaded in 2008. And when it was initially uploaded, it was a full five-part adventure. And all five parts had sound. It was just incredible. We watched the entire thing. It was life-changing. Unfortunately, through the passage of time, the uploader, Honorable Mention Productions, seems to have misplaced some of the files. For instance, there is no part one, first of all. You can find this all linked on placetobenation.com, by the way, if you're listening to this. We're also going to instruct you how to find it. If you can't for some reason access the Place to Be Nation website, if you're listening to us on Podbean or iTunes or whatever, and let you know where you can find this and watch it along with us. But suffice to say, this was a full adventure. But part one has been lost to time. There is no part one, and part five, the entire sound file appears to be gone. It is a silent feature, which in some ways is a bit of a bold artistic choice.
Indeed.
So
it really gets across the moral ambiguity of the ending of the story, where you really, as the viewer, get to create your own dialogue and wonder for yourself what you would do if you were in such a moral dilemma.
Right, right. So we don't really know much about this fan film, the backstory behind it, the funding. I mean, how did they afford to make this? When you see some of the set pieces, when you see some of the special effects, the CGI in this film, it's a wonder how they were ever able to actually fund it. But we don't know anything about the people that made it. We do know that they have interacted with their fan base in the past, the distant past, granted. I'm sure all of them are working in Hollywood now in some form or fashion, if they so chose to do that. But really, it's a mystery production in some ways. And hopefully, by bringing more exposure to it, I hope that we can find more information about what led to its production, the interesting choices of techniques that were used in the filming. I'm really hoping we find out more about this entire project in the process. But as it stands, it's a little bit of an obscurity. Probably the most obscure thing that we've done here on
by far the most obscure thing we've ever done here.
But while it may not be a quote unquote mainstream feature, my hope is that if even one child's life can be changed by this episode of the Hard Travel, we will have done our jobs. And isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that what we're all here for? Is to put smiles on people's faces?
Absolutely.
I digress.
Absolutely.
I digress. In any event, people, if you go onto YouTube, Nick, what's the most efficient way for someone to find this on YouTube? Again, assuming that they don't have access to placetobenation.com where they can easily pull up the links.
Yeah, we'll also have it on the Facebook page, and we'll probably tweet out the links, you and I will as well.
That's right.
But a variety of methods. One you could try is actually searching for the uploader, Honorable Mention Productions, and looking for the videos there on that page. The director of the film also uploaded them under his personal page, and I believe that username is King, K-I-N-G, space, Caseman, C-A-S-E-M-A-N. If you look for that user as well, you can probably find it in his uploads. Other than that, you could also search directly for Watchmen, open quote, Rorschach, close quote, part two, and the two, of course, being in the Roman numeral format, so an II. That's the exact title of the video, so in theory, that should pull it right up for you.
Yep, absolutely. With that being said, the three of us are going to hit play on Watchmen Rorschach Part 2, which again is the first one available.
Because Part 1 has been lost to the annals of history, unfortunately.
The annals of history. And we all know how bad it is to be lost to the annals of history. But in any event, we're going to count you down, and when we reach the bottom of our countdown, we're going to hit play. And we're just going to use this to refresh us on some of the things we may have forgotten, and use this to talk about the overall project that is Watchmen Rorschach. And we're going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And right off the bat, we're getting started here with the iconic.
What is the light in the lower left hand corner? That bugs me.
That's a wonderful question. But why? How did they for such a low budget production? How did they get Jim Brewer to agree to play Ozymandias? I mean, look at him. It's got to be Jim Brewer. Look at the dead, sunken eyes, the look of career failure on his face, his countenance.
And I really love what appears to be yellow construction paper around his neck for his costume. I think that's my favorite part.
He does somewhat look like my elementary school Thanksgiving project.
He looks like a combination of your elementary school Thanksgiving project and like a choir robe from a church predominantly attended by African American attendees.
We should also
skin tight shirt underneath it.
Yeah. A turtleneck with the turtleneck rolled down.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, we have to mention right off the bat the overwhelming charisma of this guy, of Jim Brewer as Ozymandias. He's really into his lines. He delivers them with fervor. He's very interested in talking about his company and kind of laying out this is this movie's way of and yes, it's a movie. This is the movie's way of kind of laying out the narrative of the film. They do it through these shots of the TV studio. It's really quite brilliant. It cuts out the need for elaborate action set pieces. We should also mention, because it gets brought up right away, this film takes some creative liberties with the pronunciations of some of the iconic names of these characters. For instance, how do they pronounce Adrian Veidt, Nick? Sorry.
Well, this is Adrian Veidt introducing his book, The Veidt Method. And here, as you can see on screen, our introduction to the man himself.
Rorschach.
Oh, my.
Look at the... You can see the Adrian Veidt clearly circling his eyes around, looking for cues as to what to say next.
I love how Adrian Veidt's supposed to be one of the richest people in the world, and his office is like all like wood grain paneled. That's their picture of luxury in this thing.
With just empty electrical outlets everywhere and cords hanging from the wall. But another name that is interesting in its pronunciation, as we'll see later in the film, Dan Dreiberg from Watchmen is actually Dan Dreiberg in this production, which is another bold artistic choice that I think really benefits the feature.
Oh man, some heavy emoting from Veidt right there. Drops his eyes.
Well, look at his eyebrows. His eyebrows are really they really convey all that you need to know. You know, I've often heard it said about Al Pacino that what makes him such a great actor is that he can convey more with just his eyebrows and a facial expression than most actors can with an entire script of dialogue. And I feel that's also the case with Veidt here. As you can just see, Rorschach's disgust.
Disgust.
I mean, he's had it with Veidt and his lazy ways. You know, he's tired of it.
Tired of him acting like a prostitute, as he just put it.
Like a prostitute. And here we see the actual best actor in the film.
I was about to say, like, we're going to rag on a lot of this, but this guy actually if you watch all the way through the credits in Part 5, apparently this guy was actually a television anchor, which explains his level of professionalism in this thing.
He's outstanding. I mean,
Yes! Woo! There it is.
The first appearance of Dr. Manhattan. Manhattan, ladies and gentlemen.
And his Manhattan nipples.
With his James Ellsworth physique. Now, David, how comfortable would you feel playing this version of Dr. Manhattan?
I mean, I feel I could, Mike could give him a run for my money. And the fact that I'd get to wear clothes would be a a plus.
Greg, here we go. Here the special effects are about to be put to good use.
Oh, my, look at this. Look at these.
You guys can't hear it right now, but the Nixon impersonation has just started in the voiceover.
And I'm pretty sure that Nixon impersonation is the same guy that does Bit.
No, actually, the Nixon impersonator is the director of the piece. If you
oh, really?
The credits, yeah.
I think he might also be the same guy that played Nixon in the actual Watchmen film. Watch the situation. We're going to go to a code red situation.
What exactly is Dr. Manhattan doing right there? Well, he was getting ready to take a dump right there on Mars.
Emergency dump right there.
He's taking a dump and covering it up, just like all blue creatures do.
Oh my god, if Dr. Manhattan takes a dump, is he taking a dump at every moment throughout time, like simultaneously? Is that how that works?
Oh, and here we see our first glimpse of Dan Dreeberg as he awakens from his slumber.
And also an important, a pretty impressive pull for the cast to get Mark Hamill out of his relative obscurity at the time to do this.
Mark Hamill as Dan Dreeberg. Oh my god. And it also features one of my favorite lines of the entire film when Rorschach briefly slips into his southern accent as he explains to Dreeberg, "You need to get some more locks. This one gave out with just one shove." Also, another thing about this film that you'll notice, everyone over-enunciates all of their T's. It isn't doesn't, it's doesn't. Tell me, doesn't it? And that brings us to the end of part one. Let's break down for the viewers. Part two, I'm sorry. Let's break down for the viewers out there as we hit pause to what we just watched. Now, clearly, they're pulling heavily from the source material here. They're trying to get around some of the budget, the understandable budgetary limitations. But what did you guys make of that first 6-minute bit there, introducing us to the major players in this film?
Dr. Manhattan is a scene stealer. Anytime he appears in this thing, it's something to sit up and take note of.
David, what were your thoughts?
I mean, just so far, I mean, the wardrobe for Adrian Vet, as they say, really spoke to me that he was rich, very rich. And
what I wonder about Adrian Vet in this one is why he would go to a television interview in his superhero costume and yet just be sitting around his office in like a purple jacket a la the Joker with a purple shirt underneath. It was a very odd fashion choice, like you said.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that he had been doing lots and lots of drugs before going to the TV station.
Well, that's what Jim Brewer is known for, is it not?
So, David, your thoughts also?
Just his shifty nature. I mean, he conveys, as you said, so much with his wonderful acting skills and his use of his eyes constantly. Whether it's looking for the answer or
looking
conveying that he's lying. Right. I imagine he'd be really good on a date. Like, I can just imagine him looking at his date across the table once every 10 minutes.
Hey, don't knock guys that don't look their dates in the eyes during first dates, okay?
I'm one of those guys, too, so I can knock them.
So what you're saying is we should start hanging out with Adrian Vett.
I mean, he taught me everything I needed to know about dating.
He also has circles around his eyes so large, it looks like he hasn't slept in like a month. It's impressive.
Again, I mean, isn't that what Jim Brewer's known for? Now, we also met Mark Hamill's version of Night Owl, Dan Dreeberg. Certainly a very unique take on this iconic character. I know that David, that Night Owl was one of your favorite characters in Watchmen. What did you think of seeing him in live action for the first time?
Well, he truly is one of my favorite characters.
Yes.
And his awkward nature that this guy doesn't really convey, but, I mean, he's awkward in plenty of ways, but not in the way that it's relatable. So it was something.
The one unfortunate thing about this film, I would say, is, you know, we just got to see Mr. Hamill there shirtless in his debut as Mr. Dreeberg. And it's really unfortunate they didn't choose to film the sex scene from later in the movie, because I think seeing him get it on would have been one hell of an arousing experience. I'll put it that way.
I think you're onto something here. And I was going to let you guys in on something that I noticed on my most recent watch through of this. We talked, Nick, when we had Russell on to discuss Batman versus Superman Ultimate Edition earlier in the year, which you can find right here at Place to Be Nation Pop, PlaceToBeNation.com. We talked about some of the recurring themes and motifs in Zack Snyder's film, one of which was the shots of horses, if you recall.
Mm-hmm.
Just shots of horses throughout the film. In this one, it appears the director also has some recurring themes and motifs, in particular, incredibly erect nipples. I want you guys to pay very close attention to the incredibly erect nipples that almost
every man
in the past appears to be sporting in this film. As we saw a moment ago with Dr. Manhattan in his first appearance, nipples extended outright to let the world know that he was indeed watching them. And later on, you may see it with another character or two when you least expect it, that, you know, the headlights are on and, you know, I, for one, am okay looking at him.
Are you suggesting that perhaps this film had like, nipple fluffers on set the same way that there are fluffers on a porn set to prepare the actors? Ice cubes at the ready?
I am suggesting that the filming experience was quite cold. However, I'm also suggesting that the director, the filmmaker, was trying to send a greater message about how cold the Cold War had gotten at the point that Watchmen takes place. So it works on many levels, but just let's keep an eye on that as we
now. I'm a little disappointed if that's really the case, Greg. If he wanted to get across to us the depth of the Cold War, you know, through using cold like imagery, then he really should have shown Dr. Manhattan's blue penis, because I would have wanted to see some blue shrinkage myself. That's just me.
You wouldn't have seen anything though. How could you?
It would have been in him.
Well, the turtle head probably would have still been poking out.
Oh, good Lord. Well, we've talked about blue penises. We've talked about erect nipples. But this is only part one, folks.
Part two, once more.
Part two, sorry. Part two. We've still got much more to come. And so with that being said, let's count you down and start on part three of Watchmen Rorschach. All right, 3, 2, 1, play. And we're back with the irascible newsman as he's, you know, letting us know what's going on in the world, all the terrible things that are happening, some of the shocking situations and revelations. Poor Rorschach has gotten himself captured by the police.
Been captured.
And we're about to be introduced to who I believe may be David's favorite character in this entire feature.
Well, I want you guys to see right here is Sing Sing Prison, a beautiful prison set right on a river next to a hillside. One of the most luxurious prisons I've ever seen.
It looks beautiful. I wouldn't mind staying there for a night or two. You know, and here you see who appears to be an actual correctional officer walking Mr. Kovacs, Walter Kovacs.
Now that says that's the Orange County Jail. I was under the impression this was Sing Sing Prison. Which one is it?
Ah, now David, is this how you're? This is one of the main reasons we want to bring you on here. Is this how it works? Is this how counseling and examined psychological evaluations truly work?
Well, you've got to focus more on your tape recorder than the person themselves, for sure. I mean, why on earth would you listen to the people that pay you to counsel them? So yeah, I mean, you have to look shady and.
Grow a handlebar mustache?
Yes, the handlebar mustache is essential. That's why I've been failing at my job lately. I don't have a handlebar mustache. I lost the power.
Do they put you through orientation on your first day and explain to you all the ways that you should grow your handlebar mustache to be more effective at your counseling?
It's Sadly, they didn't. I stumbled upon it thanks to this film, and then I strayed from it, and now I've got to go back.
The other thing that I should mention to people, yes, this is a race swap from the book. In the comic book Watchmen, the counselor is an African American gentleman. On here, he is a white gentleman with a handlebar mustache who doesn't really appear to have ever even understood what a counselor is or does.
What I love about this is these counselor and Rorschach scenes, they all the camera work is exactly the same. It transitions between a wide shot of a character's face that slowly zooms in, and then you go to the other character, and the wide shot slowly zooms in, and you rinse and repeat for about 3 minutes straight. Check it out as you watch.
Oh my god. Look at the shaky camera too.
And the zoom ins.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You start wide and then you slowly zoom on every shot. Here we go. Zoom. Come on. Do it. There we go.
You keep calling me Walter. I don't like you.
Fat, wealthy, think you understand pain.
You understand pain.
Oh, and here we go with David Sunday making his cameo appearance in the film.
There I am if I lost about half of my weight.
and regrew your hair.
I think it's actually former WCW jobber Lash LaRue.
I was gonna say the elder Pete from the old Nickelodeon show, The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Oh, this is also great because the woman never shows up to pick up her clothing. Said it was too ugly. Wrong. Not ugly.
Not
very, very beautiful. Not ugly at all. Viscous fluid between two sheets. Oh, and here it comes. I think, are we about to get it? Are we about to get the money
here
line?
Here it comes.
Comes.
There are
like you? Yes! Like you? Facial expressions make it. I can't. Every time I've watched it, I just watched it about 10 minutes before we started the show, and it made me laugh again because the facial expression catches me off guard every time. Thank you, no pain, fat. Oh my god.
The awkward stare for 10 seconds before he finally walks away.
Oh, my lord. Oh, but now the counselor is concerned. You can tell that. He instantly picks up his recorder again.
Does everyone... Do counselors still all carry recorders like this, by the way?
Yes, exactly like that. We still use the tape gun for
the little
some reason.
The little miniature tapes that are impossible to find.
I've got to critique his method, though. He only touches his chin right then. It's essential to stroke your chin a lot throughout the session.
Yeah, but this is where he's putting together his entire life story without him in the room, where he just assumes he knows everything about him. So he clearly has to stroke his chin while he's putting the puzzle pieces together.
That is true, and that's something we also do. I mean,
I also love how it's taking place in the mid-80s, but there's clearly a modern office chair directly in the background.
Case closed, he says.
That's the end of it. He basically just... Is that how it works, David? Do you analyze your clients and say, he's just seeking solace with common criminals? Well, case closed.
Yes, and we never agree to see them again. We just are like, no, we're done.
Fire! Exclamation point.
Or as they call it here in Houston County, FAR. We got a FAR on Fortner Street. Oh, God. Here again, the newscaster doing everything he can to class up the joint, to bring a little bit of gravitas to the proceedings. Well, that wraps up a very eventful part 3. and we're going to pause it again here, watching it on the app, and discuss what we just watched in part three. I mean, that was the pinnacle. Let's be honest. That was the climax.
I don't know, man. You got to remember, part five does have Dr. Manhattan actually on screen, moving around and interacting with other characters. So there's, you know, there's.
If only the sound were still there.
Oh, God.
I mean, the psychological evaluation of Rorschach is just amazing. I mean, the moment that is probably the most quoted moment from this is, like you? But there's also so much from the counselor himself.
And that exact moment, the like you moment, was that? That was one of our Facebook profile pictures for a good while.
After we first watched this film, yeah. We all that watched it changed our profile pictures to characters or scenes from this.
Yes.
I had the counselor character as mine. Yes. Somebody had like you.
I believe that was me, I think. I can't remember.
Somebody had Dr. Manhattan.
David, of course, had young Rorschach.
Yes, who some people probably assumed was actually me at some point.
It was a transformative experience for sure, and I'm really almost at a loss to describe what was so great about it, because the facial expressions of Rorschach, the delivery, the enunciation of the T's, fat, think you understand pain, but you do not, not ugly. Very, very beautiful. And then you've got the counselor who I don't want to say his delivery is wooden, but perhaps not the most invested in what he's doing. Mother died at an early age. Now compensates by hanging out with criminal element. Well, case closed.
Mental retardation. Case closed.
At an early age. What? Then he's like, I wonder what he meant by you'll find out. Oh, phenomenal. What else can you really say about that? That was what we call that personal chapter of the story, you know, where you zoom in, and I mean really literally zoom in.
On every shot you zoom in.
Zoom in on the characters to find out their innermost desires. To this point in the show, to this point in the film, how do you guys think this is doing of translating the seminal comic book Watchmen? Do you think it's doing a reasonable job of getting across all of the complex themes of that work?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, none of the nuance or depth has been lost in the translation. I mean. You know, and the scenes they pick to film, you know, are absolutely the most essential scenes, and they're not really leaving out anything that the book, you know, absolutely requires to work, you know?
David, you're a fan of shorter films. What did you think? I mean, to me, this is how you should film something like Watchmen. Cut out all the unnecessary crap and just get right into the main narrative.
Well, you know, they usually have extended director cuts. But I think they should go with abbreviated director cuts like this for ADHD people as myself, and just get right to it.
Peter, you know, Jackson, I actually agree, and I think there's a great place to start. I've long advocated that a perfect film to apply the approach David is mentioning right there would be the film Elizabethtown, in which Orlando Bloom kills himself in the first 2 minutes and the credits roll. And I think that really would save everyone the time and the effort of watching that abortion of a film.
That's right. Go ahead.
I was going to save the money for the soundtrack. I mean, you just pay for one song, you know, a classic song, and you're done.
Yep.
That's it. In addition to being an anti-Archite, Nick is also an anti-Elizabethtownian. So, you know, keep that in mind, folks out there. I personally enjoy the film quite a bit.
While I deny your allegations of anti-Archism on my part, I will fully embrace my, you know, my role as an anti-Elizabethtonian, because after all,
are we creating our own entries in the American lexicon?
I feel like we are. I feel like we are.
Apparently this discussion has killed Mr. Duke.
No, this fan film and the degree of laughter that I'm currently experiencing has killed me.
Well, remember, Greg, your maiden name is Webster, so that's when we can make up some words. You can.
That's correct. I do have that ability. I have that authority. And, David, what's been to this point – would you agree with me that so far – well, actually, let's get to that at the end, and we'll decide what the best part – what the best chapter was and what the best scenes were when we get to the end. But so far, I mean, obviously it's Rorschach's story, but I feel like some of the side characters are almost stealing the scenes at times. That's why that like you was so important. I felt he really needed to assert himself because he was in danger of getting outshone by the likes of the counselor, the newscaster, and of course Adrian Vett.
Well, especially when you watch it in the context of not having part one, because for those of you who will never get to see part one, that also had such classics as "No," or "Help myself to some beans," "Hope you don't mind," and "Fine like this."
Fine like this, that's right. And that's the great tragedy in what we're talking about right now. I had actually forgotten that they did film those, and now that I'm thinking back on it, those were just as hilarious.
Yes.
Help self to some beans. Phenomenal. Those also got quoted a lot. It's really incredible to look at the level of detail that they got on this. All the classic lines that you remember from Watchmen. And remember, above all else, Watchmen is all about catchphrases. I think we can all agree on that. That's the main point of it. It's just
catchphrases and T-shirts.
Yeah, and I think that they really got to the heart of the greatest graphic novel of all time by capturing these catchphrases. So with all that being said, are you guys ready to move on to part four?
Absolutely.
Sure.
In 3, 2, 1, play. We haven't talked enough about this iconic countdown.
What is the light in the lower left-hand corner? Is anybody else seeing that?
I wasn't paying attention. I'll look next time.
Next time the Mine clock is on there, look videos. For the light in the lower left-hand corner. It looks like a car's headlights.
Look at the close-up of this handlebar mustache. Good Lord. It's impressive.
Oh, and in an absolutely brilliant move, they give one of Rorschach's best lines from the graphic novel, "You're not locked up," or "I'm not locked up in here with you, you're locked up in here with me." They take it from Rorschach and give it to the counselor guy, which is just a brilliant piece of writing.
Not only do they give it to the counselor guy, but he gets the line wrong too, because he says that somebody else says it to Rorschach that causes the fight. Oh, look at it. The counselor's figured it all out now. Do you ever confront your clients like this, David? Do you get in their grill and do you really just oh, look at that facial expression. I love how the handlebar mustache
that's almost
on his second chin.
That's almost that's almost a "let's see what you got, big boy" kind of look. Almost a
that was
seductive.
More erotic, sure.
Also, very bold of them to go with an 87-year-old Rorschach.
And here we are closing in over the fat guy's shoulders on Rorschach's face. Look at the zooms over and over again.
Oh, Rorschach looking at a Rorschach. Wearing a striped prison suit. Here we go. Another a weird zoom down his V-neck. That was
here's a weird shot of the side of his head.
The cuts are amazing here. You know, you really don't appreciate it until you watch it on mute, just how great the editing is. The cuts are Green Lantern-esque in nature. Oh, my. Oh, the shakiness of the camera, too.
And what you guys can't hear right now because you're listening to it on mute, the white noise constantly in the background of pretty much every scene.
Hey, in 2008, Nick, things like sound muffling equipment didn't exist. Neither did tripods or balancing equipment for cameras. What a weird shot. The top
over the top of his bald head. Oh, that was the closest as we'll get to a J.J. Abrams lens flare, is the glare off the top of the guy's head.
Because, and it's appropriate you mention that, because certainly when you're mentioning this film, you also have to talk about the works of people like J.J. Abrams as well.
Indeed.
I'll give him this. Those do appear to be real handcuffs.
There you go. Real as real can
be. Look at the Ethernet cables in the background.
This was a highly advanced prison in 1985.
Oh, my Lord.
The counselor is disturbed now.
He is. Oh, and speaking of mustaches, here's our newscaster again.
Oh, two
top
stories. My God.
Is he not wearing the same clothing that he's been wearing on every broadcast for this entire...
Well, you see, all the events in this film take place on a series of Tuesdays, and that's just his Tuesday suit, is what you don't...
His Tuesday suit. Yeah. I gotcha. Makes sense. Oh, another classic transition. Okay, I do see a little light in the
What is that?
Corner. I have
oh,
no idea.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see it.
Oh, yes.
Here we go. Oh, my God.
Swimming goggles.
The 12-year-old child swimming goggles and the erect nipples.
Erect nipples, yes. I told you guys, look at them. Look at them next time they show them, David.
Oh, I saw them. I can't look away.
You can't see anything else. I don't know whether to look at the nipples or the, again, neon green swimming goggles that Night Owl is wearing with his cockroach headgear.
Oh, here we go, Greg.
Damn it, Rorschach! I'm sorry, Rorschach. That was out of line. Oh, my God. I just realized it. It's not Mark Hamill. It's Elton John.
It's a combination of the two.
The glasses, the lower part of the face, it looks just like him.
I also love this version of the owl cave or whatever it is. This is clearly, you know, bringing the comic book version to life.
It's not at all a basement.
I'm trying to see if I can read the brand name of his goggles on them whenever they do close-ups.
The goggles, they do nothing.
Is that just like permanent marker they've scribbled on his brown neck thing to make it have some black markings on it?
Probably.
Oh, now Greg, I just noticed something. You see there Rorschach wearing the scarf wrapped around his neck. Is that where Chris Jericho got the idea?
You know, oh my God. 8 years? I mean, you got to give it to Jericho.
Oh,
I mean,
man. And look, years, look that, here at the ultra luxurious interior of Vet Industries.
Vet Industries?
The American flag hanging on one of the desks.
Which looks like, I don't know, the waiting area of a police station in Anchorage, Alaska or something. and there's Vet's office, of course, with the painting in the background, the all-wood interior. And, again, the random cables hanging everywhere. Stapler in the background.
And look at his ultra-luxurious appointment book as well.
Think I'll look into this.
Oh, man. At least my gut doesn't make me feel so bad anymore. That is an impressive gut. That's a good gut.
I love the Speedo on top of it.
I love the National Day of Prayer mouse pad that has in his office. That's a nice touch.
Oh, who knew that Vet would go for such a thing?
Go for the National Day of Prayer, yeah. Being as into the Egyptians as he is.
Right. Oh, man. And this is great because...
The zooms continue.
Even though he's looking up all this information, you don't actually see anything on the computer screen at all. All you see is the back of Night Owl's head and the side of his face.
Oh, and Night Owl has just put everything together. He has now realized that Vet is the true mastermind behind it all.
If I could make one critique here, would it have been difficult to pull up a Microsoft Word document and just type some things that look like, I don't know, ties between Vet and these other companies and show us that on the screen as opposed to just having Night Owl tell us everything? Look at the nipples. They're still erect.
I really for a moment thought Rorschach was going to flash him. Like he starts reaching to his jacket. And
Rorschach's jerk off.
He is wearing a flasher's jacket, in fairness.
He has to mail something very important.
Very important. And again, they linger on every shot.
And
they
there's a zoom on the door
shot.
For some reason. And a pan back to the chair.
Okay, there's a lot to decompress there, guys. We had a jailbreak off camera, of course. We had a heart to heart between Dan Dreeberg and Rorschach. We had the plan revealed, the nefarious plan of Adrian Vett revealed. One thing that we didn't, you know, for those of you who aren't following along with us, which God help you if you aren't, but for those of you that aren't following along with us, you may not have heard the incredibly changing tenor of the conversation between Dan and Rorschach. Because at one moment, he's extremely upset with Rorschach. Damn it, Rorschach! Why do you have to be such an asshole all the time? Or whatever it is that he says. And he's furious, and then a split second later, I'm sorry, that was out of line. And then Rorschach, to his credit, instantly forgives him and says, no, it's okay, Dan. You are a good friend. You are good. I sound like John Redcorn from King of the Hill.
That was wonderful.
Well, not intentional.
Greg, not to interrupt, but I just got to the bottom of a mystery for us, if you would care for me to let you fill you in on the details. According
Absolutely.
To a thing that just popped up on my YouTube app as I opened part 5, the audio track on this file has been disabled, and I shit you not, due to a copyright claim due from a copyright holder. The audio file previously contained a piece of copyrighted audio that has been removed at the copyright holder's request.
Wow.
There wasn't any music or anything. What could have possibly been copyrighted?
Who the hell watched this? Is what I like.
some record executive watched it and was like, there, here's the lyric. Never again. Somebody out there in a prominent position watched this film long enough to see that there's a copyright violation.
Got all the way to part 5.
And if that's the case, why didn't DC Comics file a copyright claim against the entire project?
I mean, I imagine they were concerned if they found out about it that this was going to steal some of their thunder.
I think this is single-handedly responsible for like the lukewarm box office opening for the Watchmen, you know, theatrical film. I think this it can all be traced back to this and these 16,000 views, I think.
Yeah, it really stole a lot of the thunder, as you mentioned, David, because, you know, if people had gotten their eyes on this before they saw that, there would have been no 4-star review from Roger Ebert. There would have been no critical debate about this film. People would have said, you know what, maybe this is okay for a Zack Snyder film, but it's no Watchmen Rorschach. And they would have said, This is the project that distills the Watchmen concept, honestly, even better than Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons did. I mean, because just because you came up with an idea doesn't mean that you've perfected it. And I think simple changes like changing Veidt to Vett and changing Dreiberg to Dreeberg, I feel, even though they may seem like minor ancillary changes, I feel it really changes and shapes the entire narrative.
And don't forget removing the only female character of consequence.
Oh, right. Right. No, that and race swapping the counselor character.
Making sure the film is nothing but white males. That's the best way to go about it, I think.
Old, balding,
white males.
Overweight white males.
Oh, it's Trump's America now.
You're damn right.
Oh, good God. What are we doing with our lives?
I think they would have probably had to recast some of it, though, if people had latched onto these characters, these versions. I mean, I think this Dan Dreeberg belonged in the film.
He did. You know, you look back on it and you think to yourself, look, the biggest complaint you can make about Zack Snyder over anything else, he's made some really good movies, but what's the one recurring complaint people have had about him? He hasn't cast anybody from Watchmen Rorschach in any of his movies.
And really, I bet if you went and asked, you know, Malin Ackerman and asked her for her true opinion, if she would rather have a sex scene with Matthew Wilson or have a sex scene with this guy from Watchmen Rorschach, I don't really, you know, there's no comparison. I mean, how could there be?
There never would be.
No.
And can you imagine their romantic chemistry on set? That would be incredible.
You'd have to imagine they'd probably be married in real life by now.
Yeah, absolutely.
They had done this. And also, I believe it's Patrick Wilson that you're referring to, not
Patrick
Matthew.
Wilson, Matthew Wilson, who gives a shit?
I knew that didn't sound right.
we'll chalk it up to welcome home Frank Castle.
Who gives a shit? We're moving on.
All right, guys, we're going to watch the last part here, the unfortunately silent last part of Watchmen Rorschach, and we're going to start that in 3, 2, 1, and play.
And there are the bizarre lights in the bottom left-hand corner again.
And now you can they're at the Antarctic Retreat, Karnak.
Which is, of course, a greenhouse in their local town.
Which is a greenhouse and is just with beaming light coming in from outside. And they're both shocked. Although I will say that it apparently is very cold because, they're still there. They're still pointing and they're not ashamed of themselves.
I want there to be a nipple fight between Night Owl and Manhattan.
Oh, man. Now that would be a battle for the ages. Look at the goggles!
They could take turns cutting elaborate designs into glass with their nipples. I think it'd be fun.
Now here's the question. Do you think that underneath his flasher's jacket, do you think that Rorschach's nipples are hard?
You would have to assume so, based on the precedents established in this film. There we wipe as they are heading in to confront Vet. And of course they confront him in the lobby of the local community college.
It does kind of look like the Troy Dothan campus.
Oh, there he is, standing on a walkway.
Oh, damn it. We almost got an upskirt shot of Adrian Vett.
In his purple leotard.
Oh, the goggles are up. That's how you know. Kind of like when Kurt Angle would pull the strap down, you know, Nick?
Yes.
That's what Dan Dreeberg does when he gets pissed.
Wait a minute. He just walked the opposite direction of the stairs that are in this scene, and now is walking down the stairs.
And is looking right at the camera for some reason. Again, this is creepy right here. I'm sorry. Looking right at the camera. Oh, not anymore. Because you got. Oh, my God. Wait for the slow motion here, guys.
Now you
wait for the unnecessary slow motion close-ups.
You were ready for the upskirt shot. We almost got an up-nostril shot, which would have been even more
impressive. Look at the slow motion. Why? Why is that there?
Because you're imagining what Rorschach is thinking.
I'm imagining how they got that where the staples on that construction paper collar are. Here he is, soliloquizing, preambulizing, if you will,
laying out his master plan.
Indeed, but of course he's not a comic book villain.
Nope. Oh,
here we go. More zooms.
Zoom, zoom, zoom. Oh, my God, the slow motion.
Oh, the slow motion blink from Dreeberg. Up nostril. Ooh, the rare zoom out. Wow. Showing some variety there.
I am here because I already did it 10 minutes ago. I hope that you all are satisfied.
If anybody's looking for classroom JH239, it's right around that hallway, by the way.
He just said it 5 minutes ago.
Man.
Not going to allow this to happen. Going to stop it. Damn it, Vet. What are you thinking? We have to fill in our own dialogue.
Yeah, there's no sound, so you kind of have to... You just have to, you know, use your own imagination.
Hey, guys, I've been doing stuff.
Do you like to do stuff when you go out?
Yeah, I like to do stuff.
Dr. Manhattan! Silk Spectre just for her only appearance in the film, and she gets punched in the face. He just punched his girlfriend in the face, and he just was like, well, okay. Oh, there, the nipples have returned.
Blue jeans.
And a giant belt buckle, and massively erect nipples.
Hey, y'all. It occurs to me that my giant belt buckle's gonna take over the operations around here. I ain't gonna stand for what you doing there, vet.
Looking not unlike a Halloween costume version of the Blue Man Group.
And there's a Silk Spectre as she wipes the barbecue sauce from her face.
Do you imagine it was whoop-ass barbecue sauce she was using?
It's gotta be JR's whoop-ass!
Considering she just got her ass whooped, it would be appropriate.
Oh, wait a minute. Rorschach's got to be vaporized. He's going to go off and tell the world what Vet has done. But Dr. Manhattan's there.
Dr. Manhattan.
Mr. Rorschach. I ain't much fond of you going out there. You're going to have to mind your business now. Not going to mind business. Going to tell people. Do it.
Oh, do it.
And the screen just turned blue.
That was his vaporizing powers, Greg.
All that's left is a pile of Rorschach's clothes.
And here we are back at the news guy.
Brett struck today as sales of giant belt buckles plummeted. Greater New York area.
Sales of giant belt buckles, buckets of blue paint, and skinny jeans plummeted. Oh, man.
However, the field of clinical psychology has recently undergone a burst in applicants.
Oh, God. Is this the same suit from all the other parts, by the way?
I don't know. I think this one might be different, actually.
The tie is different, for sure, though.
Okay.
Yeah, it does look like he should be holding up the game show host skinny microphone, though. He's getting ready for a day off. I'm going to go home and have me some beers. What's this?
Now, what he doesn't do is stand. It's very important.
Voice.
He doesn't stand up here because, as someone who formerly worked in a television station will tell you, they don't wear pants under there. That's the big secret that nobody wants you to know. And
sure, from the graphic novel Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. I'm sure that if Alan Moore ever watched this, that he would have no issues with his name.
I wonder if maybe there was music over the credits originally, and that's what got the audio taken down.
I think
that's
got to be. Was.
But wouldn't the easier solution to that be to just re-upload the file without that music in it?
Or perhaps the person who made it was just, by the time they finally realized, it was just like, you know what? Screw it, and it just didn't bother with it. Because if they really cared, they would have re-uploaded part one, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's our loss, ultimately.
Absolutely. But yeah, okay, so the main credits, okay, here we go. Writer, producer, director, Casey Ellis. Absolutely carrying the load here.
Contact this guy.
Which is different than hijacking the load, of course.
Walter Kovacs, of course, played by Jim Wooton.
Dr. Malcolm Long is Dennis Ellis. Is it possible that's the director's dad?
I think it probably is.
And here you go. Voice of Richard M. Nixon, Casey Ellis. Costume.
What's the situation?
Casey Ellis. Makeup. This Casey Ellis guy, I'm telling you, is really a jack of all trades.
What a talented individual. This represents a clear and present danger to this country.
The only thing he didn't do was operate the boom, apparently. Special thanks to HeroMaker.com, Indiana University, Royce Turner, Jessica Toll, Channel 15 Television, Reynolds Furniture,
and the Township of Paoli.
Of Paoli.
My lord. I mean, well, folks, we've just been through an adventure together. I mean, not just an adventure, an experience. A true once-in-a-lifetime experience. And so it's time to kind of reflect back on what we've seen. Before we get into the overall thoughts, let's talk about standout performer. David, in your opinion, who was the standout? If you had to just pick one, I know it's hard, but who was the standout performer in this one?
I'm going to have to go with the Rorschach. The like you? That is the standout line and just the delivery.
Yeah, that's a good choice. I mean, it's hard to go wrong with that. He certainly he was the main protagonist. He did get a lot of those great money lines. Nick, what about you? Who did you think was the standout performer? If you had to just pick one, I know that's hard.
Well, since David gave some love to Mr. Warsharish, I will say that, you know, especially if you're you know, looking to pick someone who gives you some bang for your buck. He's not on screen very much, but whenever that Dr. Manhattan pops up, it's an experience you don't soon forget. So I'm gonna say old Doc Manhattan there.
Yeah, for the sports fans out there, if you were calculating a PER, a player efficiency rating,
absolutely,
his would be sky high.
Yep. Absolutely.
As for me, I'm going to go a little outside the box, and I really think that this last watch through kind of gave him a little bit of a leg up for me. I'm going to have to go with the counselor.
Mm-hmm.
His emoting, his emotion in what he was saying, and of course the wonderful scene where he's evaluating Rorschach, letting Rorschach take the Rorschach test. I think that that's one of the finest one-on-one acting scenes I've seen in a long time. I mean, you think back to some of the classic confrontational scenes. You think back to Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. You think back to Andrew McCarthy and Bernie and Weekend at Bernie's. You think back to some of the classic confrontations, and this certainly would have to be somewhere on that list. And that brings me to my next one. Standout scene. We're not going to standout episode yet, but just standout scene in the film. What did you guys think? Let's start with you, Nick, on this one.
Oh, man. I think it's got to be the second part of the counseling scene that opens part four in that case, where it's like two and a half to 3 minutes of just Rorschach talking and laying out his origin story as the camera zooms from odd angles, including the one weird one where it's like down on the top of his head or whatever. So yeah, I'm going with that one.
David?
I've got to go with the wonderful delivery by Dreeberg where he's,
damn it, Rorschach, you have no idea how hard it is to be your friend.
You know, that
it's incredible. I'm sorry.
That scene is just, it captures
and,
it so
and
well.
Now my new life goal is to remake Watchmen Rorschach with David Sunday playing Dan Dreeberg. So we need to get on that at some point.
Yes. I want more of that. It almost sounded, if you've ever heard David impersonate Joe Pesci in the Lethal Weapon films, it doesn't sound unlike that. Hey, Riggs. and for me, I'm gonna echo Nick's sentiments. I have to go with the evaluation scene, the psychological evaluation scene. I mean, in a span of a few minutes, it gives us like you, fat, and of course, not ugly, very, very beautiful. So that would be my pick. Now, standout episode. For me, it's got to be episode 3. I mean, we got the gamut of the psychological revelations about Rorschach. We got all of that in it. There were some other contenders here. What did you guys think was the best episode or part of this? David?
Oh, man. The best episode or part? Probably 4.
Okay, yeah, 4 was really good.
Four would be mine as well because it has the last part of the counseling stuff. So you get that, you get the Dreiberg, you know, rant that he goes on, and you also get them breaking into Vet's office and seeing his National Day of Prayer mouse pad. So all good, you know, just that episode really encapsulates everything that makes this adaptation great, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to describe this feature to someone who's never experienced it before, in just one short, brief statement, how would you sum it up?
In a word, glorious.
Mr. Sunday?
Can I get a sentence, or does it just need to be one word?
You can use a sentence. You can use a sentence.
The most important film ever.
A solid contender would also be not ugly, very, very beautiful.
Beautiful. If you've ever wanted to see a bunch of average looking people looking in various directions and reading lines off of a page, this is the film for you. I can tell you that right now. To quote the great Bobby the Brain Heenan from WrestleMania 8, are they going to do something? Nope. Nope. Just two ugly people looking at each other. That's fun. And folks, that brings us to an end of another spectacular episode. What I feel was the
largest podcast ever
in Place to Be Nation pop history. Go out, and if you haven't already, I pray that you have. But if you've watched it along with us, go back and watch it with sound, at least on the parts that have sound and are still available to watch. And experience this for yourself. Guys, while we're looking back to summarize it, what is it about, in all seriousness, what was it about this fan film that drew us to it all those years ago, and why do we continue to reference it to this day? What was it about it that kind of because, I mean, we've had a lot of in-jokes in our time knowing each other. You know, we've all known each other for, you know, a better part of over 10 years now. What was it about this one that continues to just work for us in terms of always putting a smile on our faces?
I, for one, have always thought that, you know, a lot of the time when you encounter something for the first time, you always kind of view it through that prism for the rest of your life. And, like, you know, as I said earlier, a lot of our friends group was in a place at that time where we needed, you know, any kind of levity in our lives. And when we found this, it was just like a gift from God. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like looking into the face of God and seeing him smiling back and saying, "You are my most wondrous creation."
David, your thoughts?
Just something that always made me laugh. I mean, that Rorschach, I read the book and I got a very distinctive vision of him, but it was never this guy. And just his delivery and amazing acting skills just always brought a smile to my face. So that's always made it something I want to return to at some point or quote incessantly.
Now, David, we want to thank you for joining us on this episode. Much appreciate you coming on and sharing this experience with us. You don't have too much of a social media presence, so we're not gonna unless you would like to shill your Twitter account. You're welcome to. But
David has a Twitter account.
He has one.
I do, but I never use it. I haven't used it in about 4 years at least.
Well,
yeah. It's dormant. Even more dormant than yours, Nick.
Hey, I at least look at mine periodically.
That's true.
Hey, don't forget, I do occasionally post the your favorite picture of Stone Cold Dan Quinn. So.
Stone Cold Dan Quinn, that's right. Never gets old, I say.
quite frankly,
that's your opinion. We all have a right to it, even if we're wrong.
That's right.
But no, Dave, we do appreciate you joining us. We hope to have you on again in the future. But if people are interested in contacting David or you know, maybe hiring him for some counseling services, a la Watchman Rorschach, he would be happy to play the role of that counselor for a small financial sum. And you can contact him through the Place to Be Nation Facebook page. Get on there and let us know what you thought about this fan film if you watched it. I mean, were we too hard on it at times? Were we not hard enough on it? Did we not go far enough in our praise of it?
I mean, were we the key question we need to ask is, were we harder or as hard as the nipples in this film? That's really what you need to ask yourself.
That's what you need to ask yourself. And
I don't think it's possible to be harder than those nipples.
That's a solid point.
Yeah, I mean, Now, here's a question. We're all into comic books here. It's said that adamantium is the hardest metal, correct? It can cut through anything, right? Perhaps other than vibranium, I suppose. But what would happen if you had Wolverine's claws, Captain America's shield, and the nipples on all the male characters in this film?
And Hawkman's nth metal mace.
Nth metal mace, yes. What would survive a collision between these four entities?
I'm going to go with Dr. Manhattan's nipples. I think he would best... I think the order is Manhattan's nipples, Dreeberg's nipples, the vibranium, the nth metal, and then the claws at the bottom.
Yep. I think that's pretty fair to say. But in any event, if you've enjoyed David being on our podcast, he'll probably be on again in the future. I'm certain of that. He is also a well-respected Jingleheimer.
Mm-hmm.
He's
David Jingleheimer Schmidt.
That's right. He's responsible for such popular jingles as What You're Reading and Watching, which you heard earlier in this very broadcast.
Hopefully.
And that's the one right now. But David is riding the wave of success of that one. And as I understand it, David, you're building quite the career.
Oh, I'm working on a lot right now. Problem is I'm a perfectionist, so I'm taking my time with them. I don't want to rush them out too quickly.
And clearly your sense of perfectionism shows through in what you're reading and what you're watching, because it's amazing.
That not at all was my first take at all. No, definitely not.
I heard that you were offered to go into the studio with Florida Georgia Line and Flo Rida to record a special version of it, and you actually turned them down, saying that they didn't meet your quality standards.
They didn't, and they still do not, or will they ever.
Nor will they ever.
But yes, if you want to hire me, I will gladly do jingles. I might even do bar mitzvahs, if I could even say it. Any of those kind of things.
So he's available, folks. I mean, if you need a simple jingle that'll get the people's toes tapping and get their wallets going in your direction, if you're a company, then this is the guy to go to. I mean, he will write your jingles. And again, if you want to contact David, just go to the Place to Be Nation Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, that is, and leave a comment. Tell us again what you thought about this fan film. Tell us what you thought about David. Tell us what you thought about our tales of our college exploits, and how this sadly enough, this film in a large part helped us get over some difficult times. So to the people that made the Watchmen Rorschach fan film, no hard feelings to you guys. We really do appreciate that you put this out here. It made us laugh. It brought joy to our lives. So thank you for that. And as for you folks, we hope you continue to tune in every week to Place to Be Nation Pop, where we've got a litany of great podcasts, Seller's Points, Geek and Sassy, Lucha Undead, just a Conversation Comics, a cavalcade of
comics. The NBA team, don't forget that.
The NBA team. I believe Mr. Andrew Reich is part of that, correct?
Yes, he is. He is the paterfamilias, if you will.
Yes. Yes. And we hope you enjoy all of those great podcasts. And as for us, what do we have on deck next week, Nick? I don't even know.
Next week we'll be back with the latest installment in our Hard Travelers for Hire series, and I think this will be the first one. You know, Greg and I, you and I have both said many times that neither of us have seen a bad Marvel Studios movie yet. So there's not going to be any of these that where you or I, either one, outright rip the films, but there are going to be a couple where we at least disagree on the level of enjoyment we get out of them. And this will be the first one, because I think Iron Man 2 is the first one that we kind of disagree a little bit on where it ranks in the pantheon.
That's right. Yeah. So this should be an interesting listen next week. So that should be a fun show, a fun rewatch for us as we delve into that, and also the lesser seen film Iron Man 2. Mm. So that's going to be an interesting one as well. But until then, for Nick Duke and David Sunday, I am Greg Phillips. Hope you get out there, read some comics this next week, watch some TV, and let us know your thoughts. Give us some feedback, folks. We're always open to it. Until next week, have a good one.